dodges I ride in this wind.
The truth of the matter is that the real political debate today is between those who want to see democracy and the market operating together, which means that the market has to be regulated and that we need to ensure that it doesn't produce the terrible results it's produced over the last 10 years or so. That's on the one side, and then on the other side are those who say democracy should have nothing to do with it. Let's let the market decide always. And that's the main political debate. We just don't realize that that's what it is. And so many people who believe that they support the market get sucked into supporting the unregulated, the unchallenged, the infallible market, which is a quite different proposition. Even Adam Smith didn't believe in that.
Now oftentimes we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to episode 626 of Unwelcome Guests, where communism meets capitalism. I'm Robin Upton. And the voice you've just heard was that of former British Labour Party politician Brian Gould. I don't have a lot of rules for what to present on the show, but I tend to steer clear of people who use the terms left-wing and right-wing as far as matters political. And you may wish to reflect during this show on why that is, as we hear Brian Gould on a secret deal that has been pretty much not reported by commercially controlled media, the brainchild of a lot of highly paid lobbyists for multinationals. It appears to be a power grab to try to relieve national governments of their burden of making decisions about what should go on in their territory. You may wish to compare and contrast that with the following piece, which is another episode of Richard Wolff's Marxian class analysis, looking specifically at the 1917 Russian Revolution and the ensuing government. Now, let's hear that interview with Brian Gould. This is from July the 19th, 2012, and the interviewer is Tim Lynch.
Brian, with the TPPA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which currently, of course, is between the United States, Australia, Brunei, Chile, Malaysia, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. And these countries alone have a combined market of 658 million people, worth $20.5 trillion annually, and with Canada, Japan, and Mexico also expected to jump on board. So the TPPA seems to be built on a mechanism to allow other nations to join after its ratification, and some say, is this a backdoor strategy for the world-oriented trade agreement that WTO was unable to forge? So can you talk to us about this, how you see the treaty, mainly because of its secrecy and also the possibility of loss of sovereignty? So there's a number of issues there, but I'm sure you can just unfold it.
Well, I'll certainly try to do that, Tim. One of the problems, I think, and perhaps I should say, first of all, I think you're absolutely right when you suggest that the TPPA, perhaps in an extended form in due course, is really a sort of substitute for the failure of the World Trade Organization to get a much wider free trade agreement established. And because that's run into the sand, indeed has done for quite a number of years now, this, I think, is an attempt to create on a much extended regional basis the same sort of arrangement, but it is still very significantly, I think, different from your standard free trade agreement, and that's where the problem arises. So let me just spell out, perhaps for a moment or two, why that is the case and why I think it's a worrying development. First of all, one of the problems in trying to debate these matters is that almost everybody, including myself, would say almost intuitively, free trade sounds like a good idea. Better than having tariffs and barriers and non-tariff barriers of various kinds. So who could possibly object to free trade? Well, the problem is that free trade isn't always quite what it seems to be. For example, we signed a free trade agreement a couple of years ago with China, and everybody's now beating the drum saying, look how wonderful it is. We've suddenly been able to sell all these dairy products and other goods to China. But if you stop and look for a moment, you will see that our trade with China increased hugely before we signed the free trade agreement. It's kept on growing, but the reason it's growing is because the Chinese want to buy what we have, and that's the essential aspect, I think, of trading arrangements. You don't necessarily, I believe, have to give big concessions in order to get free trade. And of course, the other side of the coin in the case of China and with many other countries is that while our exports to them have grown very significantly, their exports to us, our imports, have grown at twice the rate. And it's very often, I think, Chinese goods which are putting Kiwis out of business, particularly in areas like clothing, carpets, footwear, and so on, where very low rates, wage rates for China are obviously very difficult for us to compete with. So it's not, I think, very clear why, if you want free trade, why you should be involved in having to give up large chunks of your right to govern yourselves and so on. And yet, that is really what the TPPA is about. It's not, in other words, just a free trade agreement. It's a deliberate attempt, largely on the part of the Americans, but with support from other countries as well and other governments, not least our own. It's an attempt to provide an integration of our economies. So it's not just a matter of trading freely, free of tariffs and so on, and that would be in principle a good thing. But in order to get that, we are going to have to accept a whole range of other concessions, which in effect mean that we are absorbed into the much bigger American-dominated economy that covers all of these countries. And some evidence of this, I think, is first of all the aspect that you yourself pointed out, which is the secrecy in which these negotiations are being conducted. We are not allowed to know what the issues are, what concessions are being made, what the Americans are demanding, or what obstacles they're putting up. And of course, they are putting up huge obstacles to the thing we want most, which is free access to America, to the US, for our dairy produce. The American dairy industry is fighting this tooth and nail, and I think it's very unlikely that they're going to give in on that question. So we need to know what it is that we're giving up in return for something that may turn out to be not very important. So what are the things we're going to give up? First of all, the negotiators from the American side and elsewhere will be saying that it's not just free trade they want what they would call a level playing field. And that is an arrangement where no barrier, no handicap, as they would see it, is placed on American firms who want to do business in New Zealand. That would mean, for example, that the big American pharmaceutical companies, which really very much resent the way that our publicly established Pharmac agency decides how to pay for and what contractual arrangements should be made in importing drugs, the American pharmaceutical companies hate that because it reduces their profits. It's a good deal for us because we get cheaper drugs without paying excessive prices. But the Americans will insist, amongst other things, this is just one example, that we abandon that kind of arrangement. They might even try to insist that we abandon something like Fonterra or Zespri, cooperative arrangements which they regard as price fixing, and so on. So there are many things that we do in our own interests and which are perfectly justifiable and which we're entitled to do, but which the Americans and others will insist that we abandon. And then there's a further point that we will actually give up to foreign corporations, largely American again, just because they're the biggest in this instance. We will give up to them the right, in some cases, actually to pass laws such as anti-smoking laws, let's say, or tighter health and safety regulations, or closer biosecurity controls. All of those sorts of things we might be forced to give up by the Americans, on the basis that if we were to insist on those or to change them or extend them in some way, it would prejudice American companies that were trading with us. And the worst feature is that almost certainly in a TPPA, there would be a provision, as there has been in similar agreements before. The North Atlantic Free Trade Association, for example, contains exactly this kind of provision. And it is this, that even if a future New Zealand government wanted to tighten the rules, let's say, on the ability of cigarette companies to sell their products and to advertise them and so on. If we wanted to tighten that, and I think it's very likely that we will, then we could be taken, a future New Zealand government, or the current one for that matter, could be taken not to an international court properly constituted, but to a special tribunal in which an American cigarette company, or a British one for that matter if they were involved, could sue our government and, through the threat of that litigation, prevent the government from making that change in the legislation. And it would go even further than that if our courts were then appealed to, our courts, that is, the New Zealand courts, and they ruled that our government was entitled to pass that legislation, the special tribunal under a TPPA could force our government to ignore the ruling by our courts. In other words, a major interference in our constitutional arrangements. So I've taken some time to set all this out, and I think it really just gives the flavour of some of the issues that people are so concerned about. And unless we can see what's going on, and it's not just we, the public, who won't see, but Parliament won't see either. The first that we'll know is that the government has used its executive power to sign an agreement of this kind. Then it will be too late for Parliament to intervene. There will be no effective select committee inquiry into what the legislation might do. By the time we find out and discover what's in this agreement, and the negotiating processes won't be revealed to the public for 4 years after the time when the agreement is signed, then all of this can be conceded by our government, because they are so keen to have this agreement, I believe for political reasons, to show what good boys they are, as it were, and how popular they are with our trading partners. All of those very important concessions could be made by our government, and there will be nothing that we can do about it.
Yes, and from what I gather, once this agreement is signed, all it has to do is go before Cabinet, and Cabinet can okay it. It doesn't actually go before the whole Parliament, whereas up in the United States, it has to go before Congress, and Congress votes on it, and then it goes to the Senate, and they vote on it, and then it goes to the President, who signs it off. In New Zealand, we've restricted it just down to Cabinet, and of course, they've all been picked by the Prime Minister, and so they will all say collectively, yes.
That's absolutely right, Tim. The constitutional arrangements are quite different between us and America, and it's not to say one's better than the other. But we have a parliamentary system of government, but one of the peculiar features of that system of government is that things like signing international treaties are regarded as the prerogative of the executive. I suppose in the old days, the prerogative of the monarch. And so it's the government that makes such arrangements and signs such treaties. Parliament really has very little to do with it, and as I say, in an instance like this, won't even know or be told what's going on. So the executive here, which means the government, Cabinet in the end, as advised by the Prime Minister, and I think with a powerful Prime Minister like John Key, who has pretty good control over his own Cabinet, it's really his decision. All he has to do is say, yes, let's do it, and it will be done. Whereas in the United States, which is why I made the point earlier about the American dairy industry really fighting any concessions that might be made to us, that will be properly debated in Congress, in both houses, as it were, the House of Representatives and the Senate, before the President is able to sign it. And already we see a very large number of Democratic congressmen, I think it is, or perhaps senators, but will both, have signed a motion expressing concern that the American dairy industry might be prejudiced by increased imports of dairy produce from New Zealand. So it may well be, by a sort of irony really, that we are unable to prevent our government from giving away major powers of self-government and major economic interests, but it will be the American dairy industry that could in the end put the kibosh on us by saying we're not having this. But that's a very unsatisfactory situation. I might say in passing, Tim, that on this question of foreign corporations being able to sue our government, the Australians, to their great credit, the Australian government has said they won't have this. They're going to resist it. Time will tell whether they succeed in resisting it. But so far, our government has said, no, it's perfectly right, nothing to worry about. And in fact, Tim Grosser, who's our negotiating minister, the Minister of Trade, was reported in our newspapers just within the last couple of days as saying, yes, of course we're going to lose some powers. Now, you know, you always do that when you sign up for free trade. He's quite wrong in that respect. when you sign up for free trade, and just free trade, what you do is you agree with your trading partner that you will reduce tariffs for their goods coming into the country, and they will reduce tariffs for our goods going into their country. And incidentally, because we've unilaterally cut our tariffs almost to the bone without demanding anything in return, we've actually got very little to offer, sadly, in that kind of negotiation. But that's a free trade agreement. What we're faced with is not, as I said earlier, it's not just a free trade agreement. The things we're being asked to give up are not tariffs, but all sorts of conditions that New Zealand companies have to comply with at home, but which American companies won't have to. And if we try to make them do what we expect companies to do, and what we certainly expect New Zealand companies to do, they'll take our government off, as I say, to a specially constituted tribunal where our government will be told, you can't make laws for New Zealand. That power in these matters has been handed over under the TPPA to the tribunals to decide.
With that leaked document from the draft text of the latest investor-state dispute procedures showing that the Australians are listed as the only opponent among the nine countries, the Australian government is adamant that it will not accept the Investor State Dispute Settlement. It's called the ISDS.
And That's right.
And the Australian Labor Party has a resolution requiring that position. It appears that the New Zealand Labor Party has bought into the globalism to that degree, but not the Australian Labor Party.
Yes, you're quite right to point that out, Tim, and I think it's disappointing that the Labor Party in New Zealand has not woken up to the implications of what is being proposed. The difficulty is, I think, that the New Zealand Labor Party is so worried about being caught on the wrong side of an argument where they can be shown or can be labelled as being anti-trade or anti-growth or anti-market or whatever, that they don't have the confidence and courage to stand up for what seems to me to be perfectly sensible and clear-cut. Whereas the Australian Labor Party just seems to have that greater degree of confidence and courage. I wish we did. One of the problems, again, is that the New Zealand Labor Party, over the last few decades, has itself been a cheerleader for globalization. Now, globalization, obviously, is a much wider concept than just a TPPA, but it is a development. We could date it back to about, say, the late 70s, 1980, around that point. It's a development which is constantly talked up as delivering great benefits, but the reality is that it has not done anything of the sort. Now, that's a much wider debate. I wrote a book, I think 4 or 5 years ago it was, 2007, published a book called The Democracy Sham, How Globalization Devalues Your Vote. And that book set out, I hope convincingly, the extent to which we have actually, in any case, already lost a great deal of control over our own affairs because of the huge involvement of foreign corporations in the way we run our affairs. I don't know how many of your listeners will appreciate that New Zealand has already sold off more of its public assets than any other, that's a higher proportion of its public assets than any other advanced country. And yet we don't seem to learn the lesson that by doing that, we not only lose control, but we lose a lot of the benefit of the economic development that we've brought about, because it means that all the profits from those foreign assets, foreign-owned assets, go overseas. That's a burden on our balance of payments. It means we have to borrow more. It's why we're having to sell assets again. I mean, it's not as though the current proposal to sell public assets is a novelty. We've been doing this for years, and this is simply extending that development. Even the farmer trading arrangement that Fonterra has just put before dairy farmers, and which got through by a majority. Even that is an acknowledgement, I think wrongly, that it's a good thing to pass over some of the income stream from, in this case, our major primary industry. And that income stream will, in future, to a very large degree, go overseas. The sale of the Crayfar Farms is a small example of a similar phenomenon. And we never seem to learn that by selling off our assets and by involving foreign corporations in the way we run our affairs, that we cease, in effect, to be a self-governing democracy. And that, I think, is a very worrying development.
It is. It's interesting because the New Zealand Labor Party there is at the moment quite a debate on neoliberalism, and so they're talking about it, whereas the National Party, there is no debate. It is neoliberalism as far as they are concerned, and of course they're quite happy because, as you know, in most cases the National Party are fairly well off and they usually own all the assets and the farms, etc., whereas the Labour Party in many ways had to work very hard because it was based on the workers having to find a mouthpiece for or to organise to get their story across to the world. And so, yes, it's a big one because, you see, the CTU, union.org.nz, when I go up to the trade union movement here in New Zealand, I see four banners on their website. One's Keep Our Assets, the other's Fairness at Work, the other, Pay Equity Challenge, and the final banner is A Living Wage. But there is no mention of the TPPA on the main union website here, and a search for the TPP brings up only four links. And then I do another TPPA, and it brings up seven links, but they go back to early 2010. So even the trade union movement are not saying to all the workers, get educated, look at this issue, because if the corporations come in and take over, you're going to be the ones who are going to be getting less pay, less holidays, less privilege, and you've got to wake up to it.
Yes. Well, I'm disappointed to hear that that's what you found on the website, Tim, because I happen to know that Bill Rosenberg from the CTU, he's their chief economist, is a strong voice in support of the kind of thing that I've just been saying. Helen Kelly, I'm sure, is down the same track. So I hope that they will speak up more forcefully than they have apparently done, because you're absolutely right. We have gone through now 30 years or so market-driven economics, globally, that is. And when I say market-driven, I don't mean a properly organized and regulated market. I mean free market, that is, unregulated market, where anything goes, as long as it's allowed by the market. You can pay people as, you know, billions if the market allows it. You can pay other people peanuts and so on. As long as it's market-driven, there is a school of thought, which you rightly describe as neoliberal or the free market doctrine, a school of thought which says anything that the market endorses has to be right. The market is infallible. It must never be challenged. Now, that doctrine is extremely congenial to people who are very powerful in the marketplace. In other words, people who are very rich, very well connected, are able to dominate a market and increasingly ensure that it does what they want and that they can then take from it the profits and riches that and rewards that they think they're entitled to without regard for anybody else. The rest of us, it is said under this theory, will have to depend on trickle-down, a theory that says if you make the rich even richer, sooner or later they'll spend the money and we'll all be better off. That is a nonsense. It has been thoroughly disproved by experience. In fact, it's not even economically sensible to let wealth concentrate in such a few hands, because what you then see is really rather stupid consumption on all sorts of nonsenses by rich people who can't make up their minds what to do with their money, while the rest of us make do with a lack of liquidity, a lack of purchasing power, and that's one of the reasons that we're currently still trying to struggle out of recession. So it's a nonsensical doctrine that is being put forward. It is precisely that view of the world that the only thing that matters is the bottom line, the profit motive, commercial motivations, and the market must prevail, come what may. It's exactly that mentality which I think also underpins the topic we began by talking about, which is the TPPA. As long as it is thought the market will sort all this out, as long as politicians, governments, and democracy are kept out of it, let's be under no illusion, that's what it's about. It's about keeping democratic processes and pressures out of the equation. As long as that is the case, it is said, then everything will be fine. And we now know, as we look around the world, we look at the euro disaster in Europe, the terrible problems created by quite mistaken austerity policies, the same policies that threw the world into the Great Recession in the 1930s. As we look at all these other nonsensical developments, the dishonesty and fraud and criminality, one has to say, of the major world banks, as, which is now being revealed, as we look at all of that and the global financial crisis itself, we can see that these doctrines have led the world into disaster.
They certainly have, and there's more to come, regrettably. Brian, only two of the TPPA's 26 chapters evidently have to do with trade. The rest are focused on new corporate rights, privileges, and the tools to override local government interests. And I just got this information last night. I haven't got it enough in depth to follow it up yet. However, I mean, that's profound.
It is, it is. And you may remember, Tim, some of your listeners may remember, that there was a great project developed about 10 years ago, I would guess, perhaps not quite as long ago as that, called the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment.
Yes.
Voted by the World Trade Organization. Now, what that did, or would have done, was to set out a set of rules which would protect the interests of overseas investors in any given country. Instead of being a proper agreement in which investors took on all sorts of obligations to the communities in which they were operating, it was quite the reverse. Governments were to give up all sorts of powers to multilateral investors on the basis that everybody would benefit if only a big multinational company would come in and invest in the economy. Incidentally, investment is itself a very slippery term. It usually doesn't mean creating new productive capacity. It usually means buying up existing productive capacity and taking the profits from it,
yes,
taking those profits overseas. Anyway, to go back to the MAI, or the Multilateral Arrangement or Agreement on Investment, there was such an outcry at that time from protesters all around the world that in the end that proposal was quietly dropped. It was one of the few triumphs of global protest, and has never really, I think, been given the credit that have been given to those protesters that they deserve. But what we have with the TPPA, and I hadn't quite heard that point that you just made put in that way before, that only two of the 28 chapters deal with free trade, but it very much bears out my earlier contention that the TPPA is only, in a sense, incidentally concerned with free trade. It's much more concerned with being integrated into the American economy, having to do what the Americans, not even the American government, but American corporations want. And I think that figure you just mentioned, 2 for free trade, 26 for subjecting us to all these commitments and obligations, that I think bears out the whole contention that this is really a renewed attempt to achieve what the MAI wasn't able to achieve. The MAI was going to be a worldwide agreement. This is a much more limited, but still very extensive, regional agreement. But this is another shot at it, if you can put it that way, by multinational investors to try to ensure that when they go into a country to invest in it, they're not going to have to be bothered, as they would see it, with having to meet all the local rules and regulations put in place by national governments which want to protect their own populations. So let's be quite clear about that, that the TPPA is much more like the MAI than it is like a regular free trade agreement.
I'm speaking with Brian Gould, who is the New Zealander who became the deputy leader of the British Labour Party, who is now retired here in New Zealand, discussing the challenges around the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Yes, I think one of the things that New Zealanders and most countries who are involved, I don't know how the people in Vietnam or Peru are having to deal with this because of the secrecy, but again, it's always coming from the top. The agenda is coming, it's a top-down agenda, and of course, the Labour Party started off as a grassroots organisation all those years back when they wanted to make sure that no more workers would go off to war as cannon fodder for the British Army. That's basically one of the reasons, as well as working 12, 14 hours down coal mines and God knows what else. And so it's for the people who have got elected servants in Parliament who need to shake our servants up to say, you are our elected representatives. You're here, you're trusted by us to do our bidding. And of course, this is not happening, and it's a global thing now because the Americans are allowing the corporates to run America. And of course, Europe, it's the same. It's the bankers, it's the big money men. And so the challenge is, how do people involve themselves to be able to get more clarity and then bring secrecy to an end, or bring Tim Grosser to heel? Because he came from Treasury in the New Zealand government and became a List MP. So without any support from the electorate, he now is negotiating our common future. There are so many variables to this that we need the elders, we need the civic responsible pillars of society to stand up for New Zealanders, but we don't seem to be seeing them either.
No, you're right. It's a bit of an irony that our trade relations, and in particular the TPPA, are in the hands of Tim Grosser, who was himself, of course, a WTO official for quite a long time. And indeed, there are others in key positions in New Zealand who've got the same background. The director of the Wellington Chamber of Commerce, whose name escapes me just for the moment, is another former WTO official. These are people who are absolutely dyed-in-the-wool, committed ideologues who believe implicitly in free trade as being, without question, always to the benefit of the participants, and who are willing to sell the country's birthright almost in order to get what they see as a victory on free trade. But interestingly, Tim, because you rightly pointed out global implications of what has been happening over recent years, two or three points to make. I have been following this issue very closely, not only in New Zealand but around the world, and in particular in Britain, where of course I did know the scene very well. And some people would say, but for a little bit of bad luck at one moment, I might well have ended up as Prime Minister of Britain, some people say.
Yes.
But what has happened there, just in the last week, very interestingly, is that two reports have been produced, one by an outfit called Democracy Audit, which is a reputable research institution which measures how effective democracy is in given countries, and in this case, in the UK. And its conclusion, very interestingly, in light of what you and I have just both been saying, is that democracy in Britain has become much less effective over recent years because of the increasing power of foreign corporations. Now, if that's true in Britain, imagine how true it is in New Zealand. It's no surprise, for example, in New Zealand to find that the very high turnouts that we used to be so proud of, voter turnouts in general elections, they have begun to slide alarmingly, and that's a signal, I think, of an evidence that democracy is not in good shape in New Zealand, as it certainly isn't in the UK, as found by this audit. The second report, which came out just a couple of days ago, which I've been reading with interest, is one called Banking versus Democracy. And this is, again, drawing attention not just to the criminality of Barclays Bank and fixing and rigging, in fact, dishonestly, the LIBOR rate, which is one of the most important interest rates in the world, but pointing out that the dominance that bankers now have in deciding policy has actually meant that democracy is much less important than it used to be. And I'll let you into a secret, into your listeners into a secret. It may not be regarded as a very important one, but the fact is I am at present halfway through another book which is looking at precisely this question. And if we go back to the earlier part of our discussion where we were talking about dominance of free market or neoliberal policies, let's just recall that what happened around the turn of the last century, first of all in many senses in New Zealand, but rapidly in other countries as well, what happened was that as various economies around the world began to industrialize and to trade with each other and to develop huge assets and wealth in the hands of particularly powerful people, what happened was that democracy was extended, the popular vote was extended, and it was that development, the power, the democratic legitimacy of ordinary people who could elect their representatives, it was that that was seen as the defense for such people against the overwhelming economic power of these very wealthy and powerful people. Now, what is, I'm sorry to say, been the story of the last 30 years or so has been that the powerful and the wealthy have found a way of fighting back and restoring what was once their overwhelming power. And they've done that by weakening democracy, and they've done it in ways that we hardly even understand and certainly don't recognize. They've done it because they are able to persuade and force politicians in national governments to do what they're told. There are, in many countries, including New Zealand, there are politicians who, for whatever reason, think this is a good development because they believe in the market. Even those on the other side of politics, as one would hope, those who want to defend democracy, are worried about doing so because they know that if they do so, they'll be pilloried in the press, which is usually owned by the self-same rich and powerful people.
Correct.
They'll be told that they are unsympathetic to the market and want to introduce a centrally planned economy and all the other nonsenses. The truth of the matter is that the real political debate today is between those who want to see democracy and the market operating together, which means that the market has to be regulated and that we need to ensure that it doesn't produce the terrible results it's produced over the last 10 years or so. That's on the one side, and then on the other side are those who say democracy should have nothing to do with it. Let's let the market decide always. And that's the main political debate. We just don't realize that that's what it is. And so many people who believe that they support the market get sucked into supporting the unregulated, the unchallenged, the infallible market, which is a quite different proposition. Even Adam Smith didn't believe in that, even though he was the first great economist to point out the great advantages of market economies.
There's lots of variables around the electoral process, because all you have to do is get one or two big commentators say of a particular person, or that person's marginal, they haven't got business experience, they don't know how to run a corporation. If you go with them, you will fail. And this is what the Tories did against Labour for years and years, because the Tories came from a business background, whereas Labour was always sort of coming out of the workforce, so to speak. And so I guess there's lots of ways in which big money and big media can skew the argument. And this is where we are today. They do it now by censorship by omission. And of course, we have never really had much on the TPPA until fairly recently, because the big boys wanted to keep it below the radar.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the point you made a moment ago is certainly very true. It is very strongly believed by a surprising number of people today that the only people who are competent to run anything, including the country and the government, are business people. Now, let's just take our current situation here in New Zealand. Even if that were true, and I'll explain in a moment why it isn't true, but even if it were true, the sort of business people you might be looking for would not be forest exchange dealers, who essentially have a time horizon of about 24 hours overnight, in other words. And they make snap decisions on that very short time horizon, very short-term decisions, entirely in the hope of making a quick profit from one hour to the next. We've elected such a businessman to be our prime minister, and everybody says, well, you know, John Key was a very good foreign exchange dealer and made $50 million for himself, so wouldn't he be a good person to run the country and the economy? Because so many people also believe that running the country is just like running a business. Nothing could be further from the truth, particularly in a recession. In a recession, if you are an individual, or you run your own business, or you're involved in running even a big business, in a recession, if there's not much demand for your product, if your margins are cut, you're not making much money, then it makes sense to cut back, to save costs where you can, lay people off if necessary, defer investment, doing all the things to try and get your bottom line back into reasonable shape, even if it means that your company becomes smaller. At least your shareholders will be happy if you continue to produce a small dividend for them. That's how a businessman will operate in a recession. If you take the same approach, however, to running the country and the whole of the country's economy, So you say, we're in a recession, we have to cut back, we have to stop investing, we have to throw people onto the scrap heap, all to stop having to pay them, we have to cut benefits so that we're not giving money away to people. If you do all those things, you make the recession worse. Because a recession is by definition an economy where there is not enough purchasing power or demand. And if you do what we have been doing for the past 4 years, which is to focus on cutting back, whether it's public or private spending, in the case of our present government, because of their ideology, they want to cut back the government. They don't like government, so they're trying to cut that back. And then they wonder why, first of all, we're not pulling out of recession at any sensible rate, but secondly, they also wonder why their deficit isn't getting any smaller. However much they cut, the deficit keeps on going. And the reason for that is if you cut and cut and people don't work, they don't earn income, they don't spend, the retailers suffer, profits are lower, all of that, the economy is smaller, then it generates less tax revenue. And that's the real problem for the government's finances. So the whole approach, Tim, it seems to me, is completely mistaken. And a lot of it starts, as we've both been saying, with the belief that businessmen know best. If only we hand things over to business leaders, they'll get us out of trouble. In fact, business people very often are the very worst people to take on those responsibilities. They may be excellent business people, able to run their own firms very well, but most of them, and I know this, I was shadow trade and industry secretary in the British shadow cabinet over many years, met many business leaders. It was always striking to me that they were very good business people, but really knew nothing whatsoever about how a macro economy worked. And yet we continue to place our faith in business people whose remedies, supposed remedies, are actually making things worse.
You have to have a social component when you're in governance, because it's people, it's just not based on money. To come back with regard to the TPPA, one, it's a corporate agenda, and essentially the smaller countries in the final analysis have little say.
Yes, and, that's very true.
And so my question is to mobilise people's awareness to what's going on and to waken people up, because the footy game or the TV remote are two of the distractions that seem to be ubiquitous in our society.
Yes, I agree with you, and I'm very sympathetic to people who find all this very difficult, because they have been brought up, most people are brought up to believe that what they read in the newspaper is roughly right, that people who look and sound okay on television are probably trustworthy and decent people and know what they're talking about. And so when these various outlets and the media say, there's nothing to worry about, just as Tim Grosser said 2 or 3 days ago, he said, yes, we're, you know, quite airily, he says, yes, we're giving away all these powers, but there's nothing to worry about, it'll be fine, you know. What are people to do? They very often don't have the knowledge or background to be able to make a critique of those assurances. And so in the end, large numbers of people say, well, it's all a bit beyond me. We'll go with the people that we've always supported and trusted. So if you're, as I was brought up in a National Party voting family, and my dear parents, and still some members of my family, would never think of querying what they're being told by their political leaders, the people they've always voted for, always trusted, and they've been brought up to believe that people who take a different view are really beyond the pale. I remember when I was about 9 years old, my very formidable grandfather reduced me to tears because I did or said something he didn't like, and he said, you're a Labourite. And in our family, that was the worst thing you could say about anybody. A lot of people are brought up like that, and, you know, to believe those things. And it's extraordinarily difficult, I think, for them to step outside the issues and have a good look at them objectively, listen to all the evidence and the arguments, and make up their own minds. So many people just cannot do that, and that's one of the problems that we face, partly, as I say, because the media, generally speaking, reflects the views of those who are powerful in the economy. And those who are powerful in the economy are those who benefit from the current lopsided arrangements, which mean that the rich can keep everything that they can scrounge out of the economy that's theirs because the market says they can have it, and the rest of us have to make do with less and less. Most ordinary people in the Western world over the past 30 years have seen no advance in their living standards. They may feel that they do, but they are, to the extent that they may have more purchasing power, it's very often because they're working longer hours and because more than one member of a family is now working. For ordinary people, the rewards have passed them by. The vast majority of the rewards from economic expansion over the past 20 or 30 years have gone to the extremely rich. I don't mean just to the normally rich. I mean extremely rich. And even in New Zealand, as we know, which used to be one of the most equal and egalitarian countries, we all felt good about that. We're all involved together in that. In New Zealand, things have changed now, and we've become one of the less equal countries, more unequal countries. And that has meant, I believe, that we have less social cohesion, we're less happy with ourselves, we have more problems of crime and drug taking and prostitution, gambling, than we used to have, very substantially because we no longer have that sense of being all in it together. And in a very minor way, and I don't mean to knock Sonny Bill Williams as a person particularly, but you made the point yourself, Tim, a moment ago that it's really only money that matters any longer. There was a time when to become an All Black was regarded as really being a national icon, something of huge value in itself, showing what sort of person you were, what standards you'd reached, how much you represented the nation's view of itself, its own virtues. That was what being an All Black was. Sonny Bill has shown that the only thing he is concerned about is not being an All Black or playing particular games well or anything of that kind. He only does it in order to make money. Now, a lot of people say, good on him, yes, why shouldn't he go and get what he can? All I'm saying is that that is a profound difference that has occurred in our society over recent years, that everything now is to be measured in money terms. And if it doesn't have a monetary value, then it's not worth bothering with.
Yes, well, this really brings this one up for me, Brian. What is to stop New Zealand corporations like, say, Fisher & Paykel or The Warehouse, which I say, this is the size of corporation, what's to stop them from going to Sydney, Australia, and reflagging themselves as an Australian corporation, much like shipping companies do when registering a ship in Panama, and then telling their New Zealand employees to reapply for their jobs at a lower rate of pay or less holidays, less other fringe benefits? What's to stop them from actually doing it if things get really, really tough?
Well, Tim, this brings in a whole range of new area of argument because it involves the whole question of have we been running our own economy in such a way as to be so unsuccessful that we're losing skilled labour, we're losing investment, we're losing successful companies even as we speak. And the sad truth of the matter is, and as I said, it's a whole new area of debate which we probably don't have time to go into, but I also have very strong views on this question. And it is that we have been actually making things worse for ourselves by following an economic policy which again says that the market must prevail, the government must really not get involved in any way. The only thing the government has got to do is to control inflation, even that it can subcontract out to a banker, and who would trust bankers these days as we see what's happening. But if you ask what's New Zealand's economic policy, it is we use interest rates to try to restrain inflation. The truth of the matter, however, is that the big inflationary pressure in our economy comes from irresponsible bank lending. A huge proportion of the money in our economy doesn't exist in reality. It's not notes and coins. It doesn't represent anything other than entries made by bank officials when they decide to lend money, usually for non-productive purposes. And we have made that worse by using interest rates, which then push up the value of our dollar because it offers a quick return to the purveyors of hot money internationally. It has nothing to do with the strength of our economy, our real economy, and as a consequence, we handicap ourselves so that our productive sector cannot make profits because it's not competitive. The dollar is at too high a value, and so they go overseas, we lose jobs to Australia, and all the sad features of our economic performance then flow from that. From time to time, of course, we get very deliberate attempts in the media to say, oh, we're actually doing very well. I see a report recently in the Herald saying John Key's just been in Australia and the Australians think we're doing wonderfully. Well, I don't know. I mean, that is just fantasy world. We are doing poorly, given all the advantages that we should have been able to enjoy. Relatively buoyant export markets. Our two biggest export markets, Australia and China, came through the recession better than anybody else. Until very recently, we've had high, great, indeed record commodity prices. Our banking system, which has held back the rest of the world, has, despite its other weaknesses, nevertheless been reasonably stable. We should have been doing much better, but we haven't, because we've gone on making mistakes that we've now been making for more than 25, perhaps even 30 years.
Well, this is what we have to deal with. And yes, and to inspire people to be involved, to get the community talking, I think, again, it's what we do over the table at dinner at night, how we talk. I mean, I don't go and sit around coffee cafes, etc., but the conversation has to be continually to ask why and ask how and then what we can do about this whole thing regarding our governance, our sovereignty, and, of course, the TPPA.
Yes, and Tim, I know this is the end of our conversation, but let me just make one further point. Nothing that you and I have been talking about is out of the way, is revolutionary, is frightening, is, you know, without a foundation. Everything that we have said would have been endorsed by a Keynesian economist or by Adam Smith or by all sorts of reputable middle-of-the-road people. Today, everything I've just said would be supported by Paul Krugman or Joseph Stiglitz, both Nobel yes. Prize-winning economists, or Robert Skidelsky, the great British economist who is the biographer of John Maynard Keynes. We are not talking at the far reaches of extremism. We are talking mainstream. The extremists are the people who have saddled us with a free market neoliberal doctrine, which means that nothing matters but the market.
And thanks to Green Planet FM for this. Their podcasts are available for download at greenplanetfm.com. Now, we move from extreme right-wing fundamentalist regimes to an extreme left-wing regime. We rejoin Richard Wolff. This is part three of his Marxian class analysis course. I think it's from 2010, if I remember correctly.
Today we're going to look at another topic through the lens of Marxian class analysis in order to demonstrate to you, I hope, that using this kind of class analysis can open up new insights, can teach you about the world, things you didn't understand before, and in today's example, make an enormous political difference, perhaps as big a difference as you could imagine. So I'm going to try to be dramatic with you. What we're going to deal with today is perhaps best called the class analysis of socialism and communism. What has that been? What do those words mean? And what does a class analysis of the sort we've been dealing with, what does it have to teach us to say about the remarkable history and the current condition of socialism and communism as, in some sense, alternatives to capitalism? So this is a heavy conversation. I'm going to use one country as an example. I could use a whole bunch of them, but I'm going to use the Soviet Union. It is the most important. It has historically lasted the longest time, from 1917 to 1989. That's a long time. It is the most widely known, so it seems a suitable example. But most of what I'm going to be talking to you about applies as well to the People's Republic of China, to Cuba, to North Korea, North Vietnam, and so on. As indeed I'll show you, it applies even beyond all of that. Before I begin, I wanted to mention that on your reading list, there's a book of which I am a co-author, which I have a copy up here, called Class Theory and History, which is an examination of capitalism and communism in the history of the Soviet Union. It's really about the rise and fall of the Soviet Union. If you are interested in pursuing this, this is the book I would recommend. All modesty aside, I understand I'm the author, but there aren't very many books that try to do this, so there really isn't much choice. You can get this in any bookstore. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it off my website. Last time, or actually two times ago, we talked about the multiplicity of class concepts, the way class has been understood in different ways. You're now going to see an example of how important that was and is. If you recall, the two major other concepts of class that pre-existed Marx, that Marx is not the great inventor or not even the great contributor to, were the concepts of class in terms of property and power. Remember, classifying people into the rich versus the poor, into the rulers versus the ruled, dividing the population into groups according to what property they did or didn't own, or what power they did or did not wield. Those ideas, those concepts of class, have been the core concepts of what socialism and communism meant during the 19th century, when the modern forms of those things really came into being. What do I mean? And by the way, not just in the 19th century when these concepts were generated and really took their modern form, but also in the 20th century when socialism and communism became powerful, real social forces in the world. These were always understood overwhelmingly in terms of property and power, the very concepts I've been talking about. They were not understood in terms of the production and distribution of surplus, that other concept which I think Marx contributed to the modern world. So you have a peculiar situation. Marx was often, not always, but often credited as the father or the theorist of 19th and 20th century socialism and communism. So I'm provoking you. I'm telling you that those concepts are about power and property, whereas Marx's innovation, his contribution, wasn't about them. So it's confusing to see his name associated with something, power and property, that's much older than him, as we saw. Let me explain. In the 19th and 20th centuries, most of what socialism meant to people, whether they were influenced by Marx or not, had to do with property and with power. What do I mean? Socialists were people who were angry and opponents of what they saw as a grossly unjust distribution of property. To make it simple, a few people had a great deal, and an awful lot of people had very little. It was an unjust, unequal, unbearable distribution of property. And it wasn't just property in general, but Marxists focused on a particular kind of property called the means of production, the land, the machines, the equipment, the factory buildings, and so on. Those were owned by a relatively tiny number of people, whereas all the rest of the people had to go work for them because they didn't own any of the means of production, and so they were beholden to those who did. And socialists spoke against it. Socialists opposed it. The second thing that socialists and communists, as you'll see in a minute, did is they were upset by and angry about the distribution of power. And when they talked about power, they sometimes meant the government having a lot of power, but mostly they meant something else. They were angry about an institution that rewarded the rich with power. And that institution was the market. Because in the socialist and communist view, a market is an institution that distributes the resources to produce what we need and the products we actually make. And how does it distribute it, the market? By giving the stuff, the best stuff, the most stuff, to the people with the most wealth.